1:40 on...
16th.
2 days after Valentine's Day. Today, contact Sensitive Design, Frank McCurry, Lieutenant Nancy Reeder, and Jeff Otteson. This is for informational purposes, and we appreciate that. You have the floor. You put yourself on.
Chairman Huggins, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today. My name is Frank McQuarrie. I'm the president of the Anchorage Road Coalition and an advocate of a business process called Contact Sensitive Design or Contact Sensitive Solutions. With me today is Lieutenant Nancy Reeder. She's the commander of the Anchorage Traffic Control Unit with the Anchorage Police Department. And I think that you all know Jeff Otteson, Chief of Planning for the Alaska DOT. This slide presentation is probably going to run about 15 minutes, 20 minutes. Then Jeff and Nancy both have some comments and anecdotes that they would like to share with you. We're open to questions at any time if anything on any of the slides piques your interest. So just wave your hand or interrupt with the questions.
Frank, while you're collecting your thoughts, let me just recognize those present, Senator French, Senator Cowdery, Huggins, Senator Kukesh is excused, as is Senator Terrio.
Pushed the wrong button. Context-sensitive design is actually a process that was developed as a result of a conference in Maryland in 1998 called Thinking Beyond the Pavement. It was sponsored by the Federal Highway Administration, the Department of Transportation in Maryland, the Institute of Traffic Engineering in AASHTO. It was called in response to a growing recognition that there might be something missing in the traditional way that the various road construction design and governmental agencies associated with it went about their normal business, in that they were obviously experiencing a great deal of controversy, many delays, and failure of projects to get built in a timely fashion or at all. In fact, in order to promote CSD, sometimes 2 years after this meeting and a significant amount of experimentation with the process, the Federal Highway Administration published a volume intended to be a companion to the Green Book, which is the Bible of highway construction, called Flexibility in Highway Design. That comment, it is important to put together a transportation system that considers quality of life, was made by Tom Warney, who at the time was the commissioner of the DOT in the state of Utah and the immediately past president of AASHTO. So this movement is really a movement from within the profession. It's not something that's externally imposed. And it is gaining wider and wider acceptance across the country. In Anchorage, Alaska, our discussion started in 2003, where a number of people from around Anchorage had been involved in various projects that had greater or lesser degrees of success as far as the community was informed, formed the Road Coalition, looked at a number of current best practices, became familiar with CSD, and went out to 33 of Anchorage's community councils, 32 of which subsequently signed a resolution requesting that both the state and the municipality of Anchorage adopt CSD as a business process tool. AMATS formally adopted that resolution in 2004, the end of 2004. In 2005, the municipality established an office charged with responsibility for beginning the process of implementing CSD. This is slightly out of date. This slide comes off of the CSS organization's Context-Sensitive Solutions organization website. I have copies of that with the web address if anybody's interested. The states depicted there in orange are all ones that have implemented CSD either partially or it's in entirety. So again, we're not on the leading edge when we talk about the feasibility of implementing this in Alaska. It's widely practiced, and in fact, many people you talk to in the engineering profession will tell you that this is the way they've done business all along, that they couldn't succeed if they hadn't. And we'll get into some of the nuances of that a little later in the presentation. In this presentation, we're asking, again, as the original resolution was, that the state consider adoption by legislation of context-sensitive design or context-sensitive solution program formally and legislatively. This quote came out of a TRB paper. It was talked about extensively at the Thinking Beyond the Pavement conference. And they came up with a definition, at least maybe you could call it a mission statement as to what CSD should be. I think you all have copies of that. If not, I will distribute them. Here are a few quotes. Again, and this is something I hear reiterated time after time from practitioners, project managers, and engineers, that CSD is simply common sense. I've actually been approached by many people in the engineering profession in Alaska, primarily Anchorage, but also other parts of the state, saying, we understand what you're trying to do, and we actually approve of it. But our customer isn't the public. Our customer is the DOT. Our customer is the municipality of Anchorage. And until they take the lead on it, we're not going to stand up and publicly advocate for it, because there's still some resistance. We may cost us business. They're all of the reasons that you're probably familiar with. In point of fact, that the history of CSD over the last 6 or 7 years around the country is one primarily of success in accelerating the design process and increasing the degree of satisfaction with projects once they're completed.
You said AMATS had essentially adopted the process.
The policy board, yes, passed a resolution and instructed the technical advisory committee to begin implementation of a CSS process, including education and training of staff and developing a plan for embedding it in all of their processes.
Where would you say that is right down the timeline?
They will have the first formal report back at their next meeting, is my understanding. They had a brief discussion of where they were at the last AMATS meeting, I think last week.
Right.
I would say they're very early on. There's a tendency early to see this as an added function or an added cost or more work. It typically takes a little while for it to become institutionalized and for people to realize that it actually saves them time and potentially saves money in the long run. The fact that both have at least notionally accepted it says that while it not be in full practice now, it's the first necessary step. And we see state legislation, again, as the first necessary step. It will be an evolutionary process before you get the full benefits of it. But we can look elsewhere and see and hear anecdotal testimony as to what those benefits are, and it makes it well worth consideration. This is a slide which was one of the basic drivers for the original conference, what is known in the profession as the rework cycle. Project is conceived, it's taken to close to a final design stage, and then all of a sudden the public or another various stakeholder group finds out about it, looks at it, and takes exception, and that design is defended. Consequently, it's delayed. Frequently, it's redesigned. Often, it's killed. This is true in many businesses, and I borrowed a slide from the CH2M Hill CSD presentation that the definition of clinical insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. That is the process that has characterized much of the design and construction cycle. That is what motivated the conference. And this is the objective, to get to the point where the process starts with understanding the goals of a project, listening to all of the stakeholders. And that, again, this is not just a public participation process. There's a lot of confusion there, and I think maybe some folks in Anchorage think it's just have lots of hearings for the public. It's proactively bringing in a multidisciplinary team that understands all of the impacts that a road or a street can have on the surrounding real estate, be it residential, business, or wilderness. That's why Nancy's here, is an example of one key stakeholder group who's seriously impacted by design decisions.
Frank, let me ask you, Jeff, I know right now, as I recall, that's a lobbyist out there. Parks Highway, there's a consulting firm that's doing, I forget what the, fixing to have a forum at the multi-sports complex, and it's, I think it's the second iteration. What do we call that process, you recall? No?
Design iteration?
Well, it's essentially taking public input as the initial part of the planning process for a sector.
Scoping or the...
Yeah, I guess it's probably part of the scoping process. Would that be a trait of CSD?
Oh, absolutely. Scoping is essentially part of that listening process, trying to make sure you know all the stakeholders that you need to involve. And the question is sometimes, even if you do scoping right, you may not have caught them all. You know, right. if they weren't aware of your meeting on the right day at the right time, didn't attend, you may not have caught their attention.
Frank, if somebody asks you, where is this really working, and what are the traits that you recognize rather than a good end product in a short cycle, what would you say?
Well, as far as where it's working, I could say that it's been successful in all five of the original pilot states, and if I can remember them correctly, it was Maryland, Connecticut, Utah. Jeff, help me.
I'm not sure.
It has since been adopted formally as a comprehensive business process by 14 states, and as you saw from the third slide that I showed, virtually all states by the end of 2003 had implemented some phase of context-sensitive design. They were maybe not as far along as a full implementation, which the original participants were, but they were getting there. California, of necessity, given the magnitude of their traffic problems, has embraced it and is well along in the process. The state of Washington, and I believe Jeff probably has a lot of insight, has a very aggressive CSD program, which has been helpful in addressing their problems, which are their capacity is being overwhelmed as we speak. There are a couple of slides a little further along that might enlighten or cast more light on that question. So let me the original Thinking Beyond the Pavement conference came up with 7 core principles. And I'm not going to read the slide for you, but what I would like to do is perhaps talk about a couple of these anecdotally from situations which I'm familiar with and how they would apply. When you start the process with these principles in place, they're hard to argue with, but how do they actually, you know, work when the rubber meets the road? I can tell you what happens frequently when they're ignored, and I'll take just to give you an example. Satisfies the purpose. To satisfy its purpose, you have to define the purpose. A couple of years ago, you folks appropriated either $1 million or $1.5 million to construct a signalized intersection at Jewel Lake and Strawberry Road. The drive behind that, Norm Rochberg was the primary force in the legislature, was the perceived and probably real sense of danger for kids that were trying to cross at that intersection to get to Sand Lake Elementary School. Jewel Lake is a fairly heavily traveled road, probably approaching capacity on a two-lane road. Strawberry is a fairly lightly traveled road that intersects, and Sand Lake sits immediately on the top of the T. And there had been some near misses of children trying to get across, even with a school crossing guard there. So as a result of significant neighborhood and school district concern, Norm came and got the appropriation. Now remember, the purpose of this was to create a safe environment for school kids to get to Sand Lake Elementary School. The initial design came out, however, and the engineering firm in question had gone to the Green Book, looked at their standards, and came back with an intersection which had a 50-foot curb radius on one corner, had a right-hand slip turn lane on the other corner, which is where the kids were going. Anybody, and I think Jeff will confirm this, that looks at any manual in existence about the design of a pedestrian-friendly, safe intersection would tell you that probably a curb radius of more than 20 feet or 25 maximum is unacceptable, and many of them recommend 10 and 15-foot curb radiuses because the cars have to slow down to get around the corner. And they're much less likely to run over. The right-hand slip lane at that type of intersection tells you that the cars that are going up there to make a right-hand turn on red are going to be looking to the left to see if they can get by, and they're not going to be seeing the pedestrians trying to cross. Now, there are technical ways to address this, but the point here is you folks appropriated a bunch of money with the thought that it was going to solve this problem, and you got a design that arguably would actually exacerbate the problem. But if you talk to the engineer, they went to the Green Book and they took something that was acceptable by their standards. That identifies one of the key problems that CSD tries to address, and that's the difference between functional safety and nominal safety. Nominal safety is looking in the book, taking a standard that's been written, and saying, well, if we build it according to this, nobody can sue us, and it's blessed. When in reality, that design in place may be far worse than the existing situation. And I would argue that that's certainly the case on this particular project. Another one, another example which you will probably be familiar with, you look down to efficient and effective use of resources. My background is in finance, so I always tend to look at what's the real cost? Is it, why are we making a wise investment of public resources? A number of years ago, DOT commissioned an engineering firm to do a design on DeArmond Road, Upper DeArmond, with the infamous DeArmond curve. In 1998, the firm that did the DSR recommended a no build. Subsequently, I think probably in the 2000 range, that was put out again. Another engineering firm did another design study and came back with a recommendation that would require the rebuilding of that curve. And something like, I think the design recommended about $10 or $12 million be spent on Upper DeArmond. When they got to AMATS to testify, they went in with the recommendation that their preferred design cost $4 million more than the next one. And the rationale was that by redesigning that curve on DeArmond, they would reduce accidents by 56%. Sounds pretty good. When the board delved down into what those accidents really were, they discovered that in 10 years there had been 16 property damage only accidents in that quarter of a mile section of road, i.e., they were being asked to spend $4 million to keep, with their projections, maybe another 20 cars from sliding off into the ditch on snowy, slick days. There are intersections around town that have that many accidents a month. So from the perspective of somebody looking at something from a financial standpoint, there was no life safety factor there. There was a minimal property damage involved, and yet we were going to spend $4 million of public money to solve the problem. That's why somebody needs to be looking at it as to whether it's a wise investment. Are you getting a return of investment on the amount of money that you're pouring into pavement, asphalt, concrete? And what is its impact on the surrounding community? In this case, the upgrade of DeArmond Road would have created a 50-mile-an-hour design on the upper section, had a curve with a 35-mile-an-hour speed getting down the hill. And this is largely a rural, large-lot residential area, where people were already having trouble getting on off the road without somebody hitting them because they were already going approximately 10 miles an hour over the posted speed limits. So the overall $10 or $12 million might even be questioned, but that's a fairly complex topic, and I don't pretend to have the answers. I just wanted to give this as an example of how the internal engineering design process does not necessarily bring the financial acumen or oversight to say, does this make sense financially? Can this money be spent more efficiently and achieve more either capacity, more mobility, or more safety somewhere else? So,
right. Can I stop you for just
sure.
a moment? Yeah, Charlie Huggins again. I would ask you to think about this. Don't give the committee an answer now. We might visit at the end of our meeting, but Lieutenant Reeder, in addition, because you will be a player as I unfold the scenario. And it's this. Based on examining some sections of road corridors, beginning with down at Girdwood, there's a little egg sitting over here called a highway safety corridor. And the question is, what's it going to look like, and what do we do program-wise? And essentially at this point in time, and there's been a bill that's been introduced to this committee, that would say, okay, well, this sector we know based on its safety accident profile has some difficulties. We're going to declare it a zone. We'll put up signs, maybe speed indicators, increased enforcement. Okay, and then double the fines. And by virtue of that, we'll take some of the money, half of the money, and put it into the safety program. Sounds to me like your program really gets us to what I think is mandatory, and is whenever we declare something a safety hazard corridor, if you will, we also have to be prepared to go the next step. But how do we make it go away? And the DOT guys are working on this. I would just ask you to think about that and the model that you're describing to us, and see what your comments might be. And today may not be appropriate, and you and I have visited before on the concept you've got, and I certainly, number one, good to see you again. Number two, it may be the Archangel sent you to visit us today for other things. Thank you.
And some people might say that it was the opposite of the Archangel.
Yeah. The devil in his
But I'm sure we all would have some comments that might provide some value to you on that. There are anecdotal things that we could tell you about all of these, but time being what it is, I'm going to skip on to the next slide, where at this same conference, Thinking Beyond the Pavement, they tried to identify the characteristics of the process which we attribute to excellence in highway design. Again, these tie back to the principles, they tie back to some of the problems and some of the successes we've talked about. Communication. Communication is key to even scoping a project, and if you haven't engaged all of the stakeholders, and again, differentiate stakeholders, this is not the public. The public is one stakeholder. Nancy Reed is a stakeholder. Jeff is a stakeholder. Human factors folks should be stakeholders, because road design is not done in a static situation. It's like some of the budgets we've had in the past in International Congress. You know, we make decisions thinking that if we raise taxes, we will raise revenue. Humans change their behavior, and drivers, just like taxpayers, if what's in front of them in their car changes, their behavior changes.
Right.
One of the typical things, which is sort of the antithetical approach to traffic calming, is that if there's an accident that's attributed to line of sight problems, the typical engineering solution is to increase the line of sight. That means making the road wider, flatter, and removing things from the right of way. All that results in typically is drivers going faster because they feel safer and more secure. You can turn that around and say the line of sight was all right, the driver was going too fast. Is this an engineering problem, or is it an enforcement problem? Is it an education problem? What can we do from an engineering standpoint to address this?
Maybe. You missed one. The other day, our answer was to put a concrete barrier in the center line.
I think we will all have some comments on that as well.
Yeah.
Again, anecdotally, you can even tie several of these back to the two anecdotes I passed along on the previous slide. These are common sense things. These are things that we all deal with in our own businesses and our own disciplines every day. I think one problem in governmental bureaucracies, and this is not a criticism of bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is what keeps government function when politics are in chaos, and it's probably one of the strengths of our form of government. But we all know that it's hard to change large institutional behavior. It has to be a top-down process. You need the commitment, you need the legislative support, direction, and you need probably, in some instances, to direct funding to make sure that you get what you want philosophically. The fact of the matter is, right now, you folks and the federal folks hand a tremendous amount of money over to engineers, and you expect them to solve social problems, you expect them to solve all kinds of problems with pavement that can't be solved. And the literature around CSD and from the Texas Transportation Institute and most of the leading edge thinkers is that you can't solve your traffic problems simply with pavement. There are many other factors, and there are many other ways to address it. Part of it's education, part of it's enforcement, part of it's introducing new technologies. Some of those will be controversial, but you're going to have to address it. An interesting study done 2 or 3 years ago by the Texas Transportation Institute compared in major metropolitan areas the 5 cities, metropolitan areas, that had spent the most on increased lane construction with the 5 that had spent the least. And these basically were similar in size, similar in economic heft and might. And ironically, the 5 that spent the most had a higher traffic congestion index than the 5 that had spent the least, and the 5 that spent the least spent 0 on creating new traffic lanes. So intuitively, you always think more is better. Sometimes it isn't. Now, we have lots of needs for more roads in Alaska. It's pretty obvious to all of us. But if we look at where we're spending our money, most of us are going to rebuilding the ones that we have, making them wider, flatter, and faster. And yet we're doing that in urban areas where as soon as you have a couple of accidents in the intersection, you have to put in a traffic light for safety, and all of a sudden you're back to where your actual traffic flow is moving at 21 to 26 miles an hour on an extended trip. So why did you spend all of the money to get to that point when if you designed something for a slower but more even flow? And this has been implemented successfully in some parts of the United States and is broadly practiced in Europe. We have to think outside the box on some of these things. What we've been doing hasn't worked. Traffic problems across the country have been getting worse and worse, and we can't pave our way out of the situation. We have to start using our brains and using all of the tools available. New roads are part of the equation, but wider ones aren't necessarily part of the equation. We'll get into that a little bit later. I didn't put this in here because I wanted to talk about environmental issues, but this is a slide from a Federal Highway Administration presentation about the primary reasons for delay. And I put it down because it was a complete survey of their EIS delays and the reasons for them. And as you can see, environmental review, I'm not sure I even see it there. There were lots of reasons, but the primary ones were lack of funding, controversy, and low priority. Now, at least 2 of these, I can say definitively, would probably be ameliorated, if not solved, by using a CSD business process. Priorities have to be addressed right up front before you ever start spending money on engineering. Scoping has to be addressed up front if you want to avoid controversy. Just 2 pictures of attractive road designs and features that were incorporated. This is actually towards the end of my slide presentation. I'm going to turn things over to Nancy and Jeff to talk a little bit and answer questions. I put this in because it's an interesting graph. It's a relation of speed and traffic flow. Walter Kulash, who's one of the gurus of CSD, uses this slide because it shows the relationship of traffic flow and speed. And he says that this slide that represents in an urban environment, a heavy travel environment, that the optimum capacity of streets is attained in the range of between about 25 and 34 miles per hour. And that as speeds increase above that, your capacity actually grows down because of the at least theoretical need for greater separation between cars for safety. The reason why you have that hopefully need, which is often not observed by drivers, for separation is, oops, I'm missing a slide. Well, I'll tell you what the slide should say. It disappeared somewhere in transit from Anchorage. It shows the relationship of speed to fatalities. At 20 miles an hour in a pedestrian vehicle accident, 95% of the pedestrians survive. At 40 miles per hour, 85% of the pedestrians involved in the accident are dead within 30 days. Subsequent studies have shown that that approaches 100% at the end of 1 year. So the severity of injury increases exponentially with speed. It begs the question of why we would design 40 and 45 mile an hour streets in residential areas, in downtown business districts. The other thing that CSD brings into the discussion is the need to quantify, to measure results. I'm kind of a simple-minded country boy, but I've always believed the old bon mot that if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And we have, I think, here in Alaska, through lack of funding and lack of commitment to shall we say operational expenses, have not provided the measurement tools and kept the data, so we know that we have achieved our purpose with a particular project. If it was a traffic calming project and we spent a couple million bucks at the end of the project, do we measure for the next 18 months and see if we actually achieved our objective? We don't do that. We say it's a safety project, we say it's a traffic calming project, we spend the money, we build it, and then we go on to the next project. But nobody evaluates whether that was really successful. I think these efforts and initiatives are being attempted, and I think folks like Jeff and Mark and Bob Kniefel at Anchorage understand the need, but they frequently don't have the internal resources or the external funding for those things. So while it's always easy to dump a few million dollars on a capital project and say you've brought money back to your home, give these guys the tools to say whether that money is well spent, whether you're getting a return on your investment. This is an interesting slide, too. It's one that you all should think about relative to your city municipal designs. In the 1960s, the city of San Francisco hired a consultant named Donald Appleyard. They could not understand why in some streets the houses were well kept, the neighborhoods were prosperous, a lot of life on the streets, low crime, no graffiti. And on a similar sized street with what was originally similar construction, the properties were going downhill. There was crime, there was graffiti, property values were declining. Appleyard took their data, separated it into three typical scenarios. The top one is the street that they held up as sort of the ideal. Here our property values are going up, tax base is going up, houses are well kept, lots of people on the street, no problem with crime. Bottom is just the opposite. Appleyard used a technique called cognitive mapping, and when it had everybody on the street, including from grade school kids to the grandparents, in this slide, draw a circle around the area that they regarded as their safe home territory. As you can see on what we will call the successful street, pretty much the whole street is encompassed by everybody that drew lines there. In the worst case scenario, some of the people didn't even draw a circle around their whole house as a safe territory. They drew it around the back half of their house. They had actually retreated from the front of their living area because they didn't feel comfortable or safe there. When Appleyard isolated the factors, the difference was the volume and speed of the cars on the street. In fact, traffic management and flow can determine the nature of the surrounding neighborhood. And we've all seen businesses go out of business because of street construction, not just because of interruptions from design and building, but because high-speed traffic inhibits access. 40 years ago, Gamble Street in Anchorage, before it was two-way, had lots of little businesses along it. As soon as it was made into a 45-mile-an-hour, most of those little businesses faded away. You can see the difference in the business and the life on the street on 4th Avenue, which is a fairly slow-speed two-way street, versus that on 5th Avenue in Anchorage, which is a higher-speed one-way street. These types of considerations, oh, the companion slide to this, which I haven't bothered to put up here, Apple Yard had the residents, kids, grandparents, and everybody in between draw lines from their home to every other location where they had a friend or an acquaintance in the area. Top Street looked like a fishnet. There were lines going everywhere. Bottom Street, the lines maybe went to the house next door. And again, the factor was that the nature of the street and the traffic on it drove people off the street, opened it up for crime, for all kinds of things. And I think Nancy can talk about the Fairview project and its impact in Anchorage. Anyway, this is not an attack on the engineering profession. This is saying this is a program that the engineering profession itself has come up with. It recognizes the need for additional involvement, and it requires the designers and project managers to proactively make sure they get all those people into the room and if they understand all of the ancillary issues before they go to the design process, before they spend the $500,000 for the DSR, before they spend $1 million, which is a typical cost, for a design of a mile of urban street in Anchorage, as an example, and then find out that, gee whiz, we had the wrong objective in mind. We didn't want to make this a good, fast intersection for traffic to get through. We're trying to save kids' life so we can get across the street. Two different designs. So this is a way in the top-down process to actually free up the engineering profession to use best practices from elsewhere, to use the flexibility that already exists in manuals like the Green Book, use the stuff that's in the Flexibility and Highway Design Manual, and deliver a much better product with a higher degree of satisfaction and a better return on investment to our communities.
Senator Caffey?
Yeah, going back to some of your earlier statements about the delays that happen, having been in the business for a while, I have found that, you know, we got the funding for the project, the design is done, but then you run into a roadblock. I think Jeff could, for instance, there's some property they need to do the development, but the property owner don't want to sell it, and they go into litigation, and that can just, you know, you can't hurry up the judges. The only time they get in a hurry is when they come for their check, I guess. But anyway, we get in this here battle, and the money's, everything was originally a goal, but then here we are. And we've had, on a smaller scale, we've had jobs that they budgeted for, and everything was right, and they found some hydrocarbons in the street, or in the road, or where the job was going to do, that they hadn't anticipated. And that proves to be very expensive, and they don't have the funds and for mistakes and errors. They don't have enough money, and I don't know, either one of you want to address that, I'd like to.
I would argue, and I use that just, not that I'm arguing with you, but I would argue that actually sort of proves and reinforces what I'm saying. John, you're in the private sector. You would never go out and spend $1 million on a design for something that you didn't own. You would have investigated all of the possible ramifications of your investment. You would make sure that you owned the land that you were going to develop, and you would make sure that there weren't a bunch of issues, because you don't want to spend $1 million and discover that you can't build the design. So this all has to do with the pre-design process, understanding all of the aspects. Now, that isn't going to mean that something like your hydrocarbon issue isn't going to crop up in the middle. They're always going to be unforeseen and contingencies. What this process and what the practice of this process says is that there is a major improvement overall in the numbers of projects completed and the overall satisfaction once they are completed. There will always be unforeseen and contingencies. But as I say, if you have a more of a private sector approach in the pre-design phase, you eliminate a lot of those before you start, or you understand that they're, you can't overcome them, and you don't even spend the money on the design.
Well, I've had situations on Lake Otis, the last time they widened that, for instance. I think on 68th, it was supposed to excavate out, take the unusables out, bring the usables in, and they get down about 12 or 14, and they find stumps. And that was supposed to be the level on the sewer or the water line, whichever it might be, that they had to go. But they have to go beyond that. Mm-hmm. They can't pave over stumps and put classified fills on top of that. And so the contractor is ready to go, of course. Yeah, all it costs is money.
That's where the change order comes in.
Yeah, well.
And those are inevitable. Yeah. No process is going to protect you against that. But this will protect you against sort of inevitable things that are going to happen if you don't go through a disciplined pre-design process to as best you can identify all of the possible obstacles to success. And typically that means, and Jeff has participated in these, and I'm going to defer to him to talk about it, getting these people together. A design charrette is not rocket science. It's identifying the stakeholders and identifying the people who are going to oppose it and getting those folks in the room and finding out what is feasible and whether you can get to your objective and not spend the money first and then discover that you have an insoluble conflict.
Thank you, Frank. Let me just speak to one example that actually is outside of the DOT realm. It's 10 years ago. I was working for an engineering firm in Seattle in transportation, and we were building a transit center and a large park and ride. It had direct access to the freeway, so the DOT was involved, the transit agency was involved. It was in a floodplain, so we had the flood control agency involved. It was in a city, so they were involved, on and on. There were a lot of stakeholders, and it had become an impossible design scenario. We could not find a design that everyone would agree to, and we were using the process of talking to people individually, going back to our office and doing a design, and then putting it in front of them, and the darts would just come flying out. And the team that was working on it, we finally sort of threw up our hands and said, we've got to find a way to get all these voices talking to each other and hearing opposing points of view. And we came up with a design charrette, which is used a lot in the architectural arena, been used for years, not so often in the engineering arena. A design charrette is simply a kind of a group effort of all the players sitting around a lot of white paper with a lot of magic markers and talking and sketching until ultimately solutions start to come out of that process. You need a good facilitator, you need a good graphic artist who can help take ideas and turn them into sketches and diagrams. And out of that process, a two-day process with all the key stakeholders, we came up with a design. This was a large facility. It was a 500-car parking lot, transit center, and we resolved what had gone on for years unresolved. And so, call it context-sensitive design. It was 1996, so it predates the 1998 date that you put on your slide, but the process is the same thing. Stakeholders in the room listening to each other, realizing that their point of view has to budge a little bit because there are other points of view too. And this is good stuff. And I think we've got Mark Nyholt here, who was in charge of our design standards, and he can talk about to the degree that DOT is now doing it. But transportation is complex. We're no longer about just moving cars. We move cars in the context of a community. We move pedestrians, we move bicyclists, we facilitate flow of traffic in and out of businesses. There's a lot of different issues involved, and if you take and let your design be driven by any one of those needs or those groups, you're obviously missing the boat for several other groups. So you have to find that art of compromise.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When Frank and I don't know, Frank, midsummer, we were talking about this, yeah. I think. And then, you know, it was hard for me to conjure up in my mind, you know, an example and, you know, how we could have something like this evolve. And then as I was working on some other things conceptually, looking at comparative aspects, the intersection of the parks and the Glen Highway came to mind. You know, that was used to be a nightmare for those people that drove to Anchorage. And now it's just a blur of a vision of, well, it could have never been that bad. Well, it was worse than that bad. And now people go cruising there at 65 miles an hour because of the limited access. So, and then lo and behold, the nightmare of traffic and Big John and Hollis, you know, having come to meetings out there, and we had a couple of transportation meetings, it was hard to get to. And now, with the limited access almost into Wasilla, you have that cruise control environment where people just, I mean, you're there and it's relatively safe. The accident profile has gone down. But it's the byproduct is, you know, we have something that was a nightmare, and everybody was getting gray hair if they had to drive that zone. It was dangerous. And, oh, by the way, now it's just, wasn't it always been that way? I don't know how much money it cost us to do that. It was a double handful. And whether we paid too much or we made too many mistakes, I don't know. What do you think in retrospect about that area, though?
Oh, I think that's been a very good solution. And have we paid too much money? I don't think so. That facility will be serving us 50 years from now.
Yeah.
And there's not a cost-benefit model in the world that can measure a benefit beyond 20 years because of the way you discount benefits. But you know, beyond 20 years, when the benefits are set to zero in any cost-benefit model, that facility will still be delivering for society.
Yeah, I guess my concern with Alaska, though, is that based on huge geographical area, division of attention, the ability to pull the team together, as you described.
Lieutenant Reeder's got a story about 15th Street at Anchorage, which is well worth your hearing.
Okay.
I was thinking I was going to get out of here without talking, but apparently that's not going to happen. Thank you. I'm not quite as eloquent as Mr. McQuarrie is. I'm just a road cop, to be perfectly honest. But several years ago, we had a motor officer who is now retired that was one of my more aggressive motorcycle officers. And he was working on 15th Avenue as it approaches downtown Anchorage, coming westbound from the Merrill Field area. And if any of you gentlemen remember, that area was 40 miles an hour as it traveled from the Lake Otis area and then dumped down into a 30 mile an hour zone as it crested a pretty significant grade on a hill. It was flat once it reached the top of the hill, and it was four lanes. There was a design that went in when they decided to redo that portion of the South Fairview area that put a slight curve in it, flattened out that grade, and then ultimately a median with a lot of landscaping was put in. In the interim, however, this particular officer was using that area as one of his areas that we needed to work, very much so, because that 40 dropping into a 30 in reality was a 70 that dropped into about maybe a 60, maybe a 50, depending upon the time of day. Some very excessive speeds, and for those of you that are familiar with that area, there's a lot of pedestrian traffic there, a lot of school-aged children. He was working there while they were doing the construction on the roadway, and continued to see that the traffic before the median area and the landscaping was put in, he was continuing to be able to write a considerable amount of citations there. And in fact, had the dubious distinction, I suppose, through the motoring public in Anchorage of being the high citation writer for that particular year. Revenue is a whole other issue, obviously. Once the median went in and that the road construction was complete and the landscaping was in and the raised median and the containers and everything, the officer realized that he no longer had the ability to go there and do aggressive traffic enforcement because the speeds had reduced, and they had reduced to what we had hoped that they would based upon the redesign of that roadway, the flattening of the it didn't actually flatten it out, but it reduced the grade. It put in the landscape divider and containers, which gives motorists a review, if you will, a reference, if you will, to be able to slow down and monitor their speed. So we had to move on to other pool, shall we say, to work. But it was interesting to see that. I mean, he was an officer for many, many years, and knows the aggressive areas in town, and to watch him working that particular area throughout the beginning of the project, the middle of the project, and then at the end, and him realizing that, you know what, this worked. It actually worked, and it slowed traffic down, and that's a testimony from an officer that had been around for many, many years, saying that that type of thing actually does work. Earlier today, we were Jeff and Frank and I were sitting in a meeting talking, and I came up with a thought that there's a movie, I believe, Field of Dreams, that this quote that was from that movie, "If you build it, they will come." And you know, that's kind of ironic when you stop and think about it. If you build a flat, wide roadway, they will come. And they will. And who's going to come are the younger drivers, the drivers that are aggressive drivers, the drivers who like the flat, wide open spaces. And I guess you could say I'm an end user of the actual end users. That's kind of an odd statement, but I'm the person, and the people that work for me in the traffic division are the people that see the end result of the users of these flat, wide roadways. We're the ones that go out at 3 o'clock in the mornings, and we see the tragedies that occur based on these flat roadways. I've been with the police department, this is my 22nd year, and I've seen a lot of roadway design issues in Anchorage. I've seen a lot of reactionary redevelopments of roadways when we've had fatalities, and it's a knee-jerk reaction to try to go in and fix something, and looked at the millions of dollars that we put in on roads trying to move traffic faster and get traffic moving through, when in reality we're really not moving it any faster. We're making more problems, and we have people dying on our roads as a result of that. And I guess I would end this with saying that the cost of a life is just, it's not worth it. The roadway exchange you talk about on the Parks Highway, was that worth it? If we saved one life, in my mind, it was worth it, absolutely. And I feel pretty strongly about that.
Well,
very good. Senator
Cowdery, something that's been in the political arena is Lake Otison Tudor, more turn lanes. And I've always said, it's the cars that's the problem. Turn lanes don't solve anything. We got too many cars on that road. I live on Lake Otis. Mm-hmm. 60,000 cars go by my house every day. And the earlier testimony with the heavy traffic is actually true.
The 70,000 was the last count per day at Lake
Otis. Yeah, that was
up
at Lake Otis and Tudor. I live a little bit further out in the sticks, you know. But anyway, if we can get rid of some of them cars over, like on the valley, on over to the Bergara extension and everything, I think Lake Elson Tudor will probably solve I think half the traffic there that's coming from the hillside will use Bergara.
John, given Nancy's employment, I think it would not be fair to ask her to answer that question directly, but I will make a comment. And I won't suffer any political consequences of any severity anyway. That was a very wise decision. And typically this comes with the ability to measure results. There is a very good example on a much larger scale than this of the reconstruction of a major freeway intersection back east that cost $800 million. Now these folks made the decision, but they also had the tools to measure results. And the fact is, there was so much disruption of traffic and loss of time loss during construction, that their estimates, based on what they saw the finished project delivered in terms of increased mobility, it would never equal the time loss during that 3 years of traffic interruption. You can infer the same thing on a much smaller scale with Lake Otis and Tudor. It is at maximum capacity. You interrupt that at any point. In any way, that traffic has to go somewhere else, but every other intersection, major intersection coming into Anchorage, is in the same state during rush hours in the morning. So my opinion, and I think a lot of other folks' opinion that are much more qualified than I am, is that it would have been a disaster if they tried to do that without providing some alternative for those cars.
Thanks, Senator Page.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will this proposal come to us in the form of a piece of legislation, or what will we do to put our official stamp of approval on this idea?
Well, we would be happy to work with you on legislation. I think in the material that was sent around yesterday by Deb, I included a couple of alternatives. There was a proposed model legislation the National Council of State Legislators developed in cooperation with Scenic America. There was a copy of the Illinois statutory implementation of CSD as a model. There was also a copy of what Washington State did several years ago, and that was an executive order of the governor. Now, at the moment, I think it's probably much more likely that we could, that the legislature would act on something like this than the governor's office, given the preoccupations that it's suffering from right now. I would like to see this committee propose committee legislation and see if we can get legislation through this year. And I don't see any point in reinventing the wheel. We've got multiple other states as examples, and we know what the results have been there. I would say we should take a look at the language, perhaps the Illinois one is adequate, and start with that.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. I'll do that. I'll take a look at the materials. And I guess my concern, if any, is that, you know, we just not do something that's toothless if we're really going to do a piece of legislation that calls for us to begin by listening. You know, and not making the mistake of getting three quarters of the way through a project before we find out that people don't support it or it's not supported by the design team, and then there should be some fairly tight mechanisms, if you will, to make sure you get it right in the first place. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make. Time and time we see ourselves going off on a tangent, if you will, based on maybe one person's idea about what we need to be doing, and we see everybody else sort of pushed to the side. So my view would be that if we're going to do a bill, it has some teeth in it so that, you know, we get a good result the first time.
I would agree, and from what I've seen elsewhere, there have been two approaches. There have been some bills that just required implementation at the policy level and just left it up to the DOT and the other agencies to implement it without any requirement to report back or to establish measurable goals. The other side of that is you can pass that legislation with that general requirement, but ask for regular report back on the progress of implementation. And there are examples, and I would say that probably the two best ones to look at in terms of the mechanics would be the state of Washington. They're well along in the process and have it well documented on their webpage on CSS, CSD. And the state of California has published a great deal of structural material on the things that they had to do internally in their business processes down to and including changing job descriptions and making specific accountability part of those jobs.
Yes, Senatorial?
But is there a current statutory bar to implementing this, or you just feel that the department needs clear direction to do it? If this is the better way of designing facilities, why wouldn't you do it?
Well, and I think, and there was a quote that I left out from the commissioner of the Georgia Department of Transportation that said, when it was being established in his state, that these are new business processes. We have to change. We're not being successful what we're doing. There is always going to be pushback. I think if we wait over time, since CSD is now part of the curriculum of most major transportation and traffic management schools, that if we wait long enough, enough young engineers will come in who are thoroughly grounded in it, and it will just become the practice. But I would say the cost in waiting is tremendous. The opportunity here is to, and it, again, it has to be a top-down effort, as was identified by the original conference, to make this a requirement. Many people don't want to change. Where you have institutions that have been doing something a certain way for a long time, it's hard to get them to change. It will happen if you don't do anything, but it might be 10 years or 15 years. It takes a while to rotate new blood, new ideas into an organization. So you can do it legislatively. Obviously, one of the only other ways to control what agencies do is through their funding. You know, earmarks get a lot of criticism now, but point of fact, that's one way to change the direction an agency is going. So you know the tools better than I and the problems associated with it. All I'm telling you is that, from my experience, that this is very close to the business process type reengineering I've seen in many industries in the private sector. It's maybe a little more complex doing it within a governmental structure, but we have models of success in other states. So let's do it. You've got bright people in the DOT that are quite capable of seeing what was done elsewhere and saying, we can do that or we can't do that, and coming back and justifying the decisions and the courses to you, and probably getting good results.
There may be one legal argument for the statute if you want to go there, and that is that we live in a world where we've had hard, rigid standards for transportation. We design roads to the standards, and we can stand up to a court test if there's a tort claim. Under context-sensitive design, you are modifying standards to let all these other interests have a say, so that the design engineer is sort of going out on a limb and not necessarily following the rule book that's been in place for 30 or 40 or 50 years. He's modifying that design to take into account other factors. Without some legal backstop, I can see where you will probably, you know, sometimes the engineers will resist a change, not because they think it's a bad idea. They're worried about their personal liability for doing something that is, say, not following the rule book slavishly.
So you're looking for innovation and flexibility and those kinds of things rather than a rigid template. Are there states that have used an incentive program to get this product?
Not that I'm familiar with. I'm not sure what you're asking, Charlie.
Well, you know, essentially, maybe roads aren't a good example, but, you know, where there's a project. Let's say we're going to build the Empire State Building. And part of the incentive for those at certain categories, the design, the construction, if you come in under budget, under time, you know, there's a bonus factor.
On a project-by-project basis, you could probably do something like that if there was a demonstrated implementation. I'm not sure how you would measure that again.
No, I understand. I mean, I'm just thinking about how you motivate people and how you reward people.
Mm-hmm. I certainly think in CSD, and as we've seen it implemented elsewhere, there certainly is a place for stressing the value, economic value of value engineering.
Right.
Right now in the process, there really is no incentive to even look at costs with the idea of saving money. If you look at it, once it leaves the appropriator's hands, it goes into basically an engineering process without any significant financial analysis or review by any of these other stakeholders. It's often just a steamroller that goes ahead. But again, understand that the thrust of CSD isn't to spend less on roads, it's to get more value for the money that you do spend. As I say, I see in analyzing some of the projects around Anchorage, we've spent a lot of money. We started with a two-lane road, and we've ended up with a two-lane road, but we spent $10 million a mile to do it. And in many instances, arguably, it could have been done as a safety improvement project with some turn lanes at intersections and achieved exactly the same result as far as safety, capacity, and mobility were concerned. So, on the legal front, one comment I would like to make, because I've gotten information on this significantly. The history elsewhere in court cases is that if there is a statutory basis for implementation, and if the decision process is well documented, lawsuits are generally unsuccessful. They're as unsuccessful against this process as they are against the traditional one, and maybe more so. A further amplification of that, we had the advantage of having a fellow named Peter Swift up here a year and a half ago, who is nationally recognized expert on design standards, and he's a recognized expert in front of both the Ninth and Eighth U.S. Circuit Courts on transportation matters. And he said, given the changes of the demands of the transportation engineering, the things Jeff was talking about, that the transportation engineer can no longer be just concerned about cars or trucks and mobility, but he's got a corridor that has to accommodate pedestrians, bicyclists, and other activities, that Peter has already getting calls from attorney in California, which is where all questionable things start, that in point of fact, the liability could switch completely because you're designing a facility which says this is safe for pedestrians, it's safe for bicyclists, it's safe for vehicles. And if it isn't, you're more likely to get sued than in the opposite, where you implemented a measured, reasoned design process and justified it as you went along. So some of the more extreme theorists with that, if you go to Europe, you see people like Hans Mondermann in the Netherlands, who has basically gotten away from separation, has implemented over a large part of the country a much lower speed limits, removed most of the signs, and strangely enough, traffic flow improved, capacity improved, and safety improved. And that was I can only attribute to a psychological thing. Part of safety in driving vehicles is the perception that there's some danger. When you're driving on a big wide road and you're out in the middle of the desert and there's no vertical friction, you feel comfortable, you feel safe, and you have a difficult time going under 90 miles an hour, is my experience. If you're driving in a more smaller, narrow environment with lots of activity around, you tend to pay a lot of attention. And his theory is that in the middle of towns in Europe, there are no signs when you come to major squares and plazas, and the drivers and the pedestrians and the bicyclists are all sort of negotiating their way. Psychologically, I recognize it myself. If I'm going 30 miles an hour, I'll slow up and let somebody get in, or I'll stop and let a pedestrian cross. If I'm going above 40, I try not to stop for anything. So the human factors part of this, and there's a lot of research on this as well, is a part, especially in urban design, where you really have all of these things thrust together. You don't have any choice. So that's another argument for CSD, because it does require that you bring all of these other disciplines into the decision-making process. I just met a fellow who's now the Safe Routes to Schools manager for the DOT. You look at the, again, going back to one example I'm very familiar with, the Strawberry and Jewel Lake intersection. One of the reasons there's such a perceived potential safety problem there is that that's a magnet school for the Japanese immersion program. So here we have, in the rush hour, an extra 100 or 200 cars all arriving at the same time to drop kids off or pick kids up at the oldest school with the smallest footprint in Anchorage. You know, why wasn't the school district a part of this overall traffic thing? Why did all of a sudden they create a program that actually exacerbated a tenuous traffic situation to start with, and has probably accelerated the need to rebuild Jewel Lake Road by a number of years? When I asked the school district, why don't you move the Japanese immersion program over to the Kincaid School, that has 30 acres of land and its access is off of a much less traveled road, they said, well, that would mean the teachers at Kincaid would have to move to Sand Lake, and Kincaid's a brand new school and they don't want to do that. So you have all of these decisions that create unfortunate results, and some of them are totally unjustified. You know, that the school district should be coordinated in its plans and should have the expertise on staff to understand their impacts on Jeff or Nancy or Howard Holton. Those kind of things aren't happening. Those are some of the things that CSD helps encourage, if not enforce.
Jeff, is there another subject matter expert you wanted us to hear from today?
No, he turned out not to be available.
Well, it's an interesting proposition. Yeah, I guess as I look around this table, it brings to mind this. You know, John, the oldest guy here, by age, I'm a little bit
easy older. There.
But by habit, you know, if I were going to choose a legislator kind of guy to, given if we all had equal capability, I would choose myself because I don't have any habits, good or bad, and you could say this is the right way to do it. And you start off from almost ground zero to how to do legislative things. John would be a different test of that, how do you modify habits of people that over time? I'm not asking you to answer that. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking about our workforce, because as I recall, we have a relatively senior engineer workforce, but we're now looking at the challenge of how we replace the people who are going to retire in the not-too-distant future. But that's, I suppose, that's just the product in the natural part of the beast and the challenge.
And one point I should make, in all fairness, I think there are some of the project managers that are consistently using as many of these tools as are available to them right now. It's not that CSD isn't practiced in any form or measure within DOT or even the municipality of Anchorage. But the problem is consistency. The fact that you have David Post, who put together a pretty good process on the freeway-to-freeway connection and got a lot of consensus built. We don't know whether it's going to be successful or not, but that was because it was David Post and he chose to use that process. It's what implementing CSD from top down says. Everybody needs to be using these processes. I would be happy to work with the committee or anybody on the committee if they're interested in pursuing legislation.
Again, if you would work through Debbie and we'll coordinate. It's a fascinating thing. It's one of those. It's like an introduction to most things. Initially, you gotta feel it a little bit before you can get into comfort zone, and we'll go from there. We certainly appreciate it. I know that each of us have places to go and things to do. Frank, number one, nice to see you again, and thanks for the opportunity, and you know, throwing a challenge down before us. And I know that guys like Jeff can recognize the benefit of potentially, you know, what comes along with it. Nancy, thank you for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Tell Rob Yoon I said hello.
I will.
Okay. Are there any additional comments or questions?
No. I know, like I said, I live out in Lake Otis Road, and when they first, it was a gravel road when I first moved there.
I told you he's the old guy, didn't I?
I'm old. I'm older than most parrots. But anyway, we had a shop there, and everything, they started to talk about widening the road, and I talked to one of the legislators down here, and I had a dog, a shop dog, but he was a family dog, and he kind of hung around the shop, went out, called Duke, a big lab. And we was talking about the widening and more traffic in Lake Otis, and I was concerned because Duke had a girlfriend that he had to go across pretty regular across Lake Otis, and I didn't think he'd make it because his focus wasn't really on the traffic. Really. And anyway, Dick, they put the road in, and luckily for Duke, his girlfriend moved someplace else, and he didn't have to cross Lake Otis, and he lived to be a ripe old age. But I, like I said, at that time, I didn't want them to widen Lake Otis. And they did, and it's something that should have been happened. And it's like I've said earlier on McGraw. My grandson lives off on Adaloo, and he don't want that. I've told him the story about Duke, and he remembers Duke, you know. And get over it, Chuck. I tell him, you know, it's going to happen. And anyway, so everybody changes their mind, but I've been here 55 years or lived in Anchorage within two blocks of where I live right now. And you've seen a lot of changes. And sometimes at the time, I didn't think it was a good change, but I have to say that I think Anchorage is my town. It's my, it turned out the way I wanted it. And if we can get the Palmer Highway or whatever you want to call it tied into the Seward Highway, and some of the places to take the traffic off of the hillside and everything, I think it'll be a better town too. So I appreciate coming up with some new ideas anyway, that's about all I had to say. I knew you was interested in Duke.
Yes,
you
know. Long live Duke. We're adjourned.